This week, the precious metals stole the spotlight as equities investors booked some of those profits, turning instead to the gold and silver shares. Welcome, everybody. Your host, Chris Walczak. It's great to be back with you again. Well, with much of the nation blanketed under a late winter snow cap, most of us are a bit anxious for warmer weather. And here's a warm mug of hot cocoa for all of my precious metals investors. After 7 weeks of selling, well, the sector finally turned up sharply this week, partially on rumors of a big QE installment ahead in the Eurozone and dovish talk from the Fed this week. Joining me with his outlook on the sector, Peter Granditch says every investor needs a financial bug-out plan, and guess what needs to be in that plan? This week's congressional meeting, he says, did little to restore Fed transparency. It's time to pull back that curtain at the Fed. And when the truth is finally known that all the gold reserves have been rehypothecated, the global financial markets will not respond kindly. Thanks to fiscal irresponsibility for decades, the Fed has been forced to manage all of the impossible task of financing our debt. That's just leading to more and more currency wars and conflicts around the world. And then Bob Hoy joins the show. He says QE operations is eroding our purchasing power. He's also concerned about the equities markets, which could be reaching a 2007 bubble-like top. But he's a big fan of gold and silver. He likes the fact that the XAU and the HUI have been outperforming the bullion and sees weakness as an opportunity to pick up solid junior shares, particularly those with robust earnings prospects. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Partly cloudy skies appeared over the precious metals sector this week on dovish talk from the Fed, as well as the return of gold traders in China following New Year's celebrations. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold added $10, ending at around $12.13 an ounce. Silver added about 28 cents, nearly 2% at $16.51 an ounce. The XAU Gold and Silver's Equities Index added 2.7 points, finishing at 77, while West Texas Intermediate crude was off about $1 a barrel, 2%, just shy of $50. Well, the top story driving the precious metals market this week, a Commerce Department report on Friday showed that the U.S. economy expanded at a weaker than expected pace. The U.S. GDP grew at about 2.2% on an annualized basis, and that was down considerably from the 2.6% expectations. The household spending was revised lower. Nevertheless, slower output was viewed as a plus for gold investors, given that the Fed is far less likely to raise rates with sluggish numbers and weak inflation. The next FOMC meeting is slated for March 17th and 18th next month. In related news, the precious metals sector rebounded from multi-month lows following the Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen's dovish interest rate comments in a testimony before the Senate Banking Committee. Guidance shifted, in particular, the time frame of the rate hikes. The chair noted improving U.S. labor market conditions and low inflation levels, but highlighted the sluggish GDP figures. She also mentioned increased demand from China and dollar weakness as a positive. However, the U.S. dollar subsequently rallied this week with technical signs of a potential breakout to yet new highs in one of the most spectacular market rallies in decades. She said that no rate hikes are likely until inflation gets stronger, so gold investors will now be watching price levels and government inflation reports closely. Another big plus putting support under bullion this week, buyers returned in China after celebrations ended during the week-long holiday on Wednesday, plus the global holdings in gold-backed ETFs increased yet again on Tuesday. That was the fifth straight gain and the biggest since October of last year. Gold's added just shy of 2% this year amid inflationary measures imposed in the Eurozone to combat deflation and debt crises. In fact, the European Central Bank is now expected to implement a new QE plan, perhaps next week or within the next few weeks, to help revive economic conditions. Precious metals bottom line. Well, the dollar rally continues to make investors nervous and appears capable of sustaining the uptrend for many months. perhaps longer. Clearly, investors are in a holding pattern, waiting to see if the Fed pulls the trigger on rates. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly cloudy weather appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week on Friday. The Dow Jones Industrials Average finished a three-week winning streak with a fractional loss of merely 8 points, ending at 18,132. The S&P 500 dropped 6 points, ending at 2104, and the NASDAQ actually bucked the trend, picking up 8 points, ending at 4963, still with its eyes set on that magic 5,000 level, not since seen since the year 2000. Investors were nonplussed by lackluster economic reports this week, despite the Fed Chair's pledge to hold rates steady. In fact, on Thursday, John Williams, president of the San Francisco Fed, said that the central bank can't wait until inflation is back above 2% before hiking the short-term interest rates. In addition, another Fed governor contradicted the Fed chair, noting that rate hikes should remain an option for the upcoming June meeting. So investors, I think, viewed this lack of unity among the Fed governors as a potential sign that officials could take the liquidity trough from the digital exchange floor, disappointing millions of algorithm robot traders. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, the 7-indicator sentiment index is still showing considerable signs of greed, despite the small setback this week. And this suggests that a little bit too much positivity remains in the market. So I wouldn't be surprised to see either sideways or perhaps even some more selling in the next week or so. Perhaps a retest of the breakout level is in the cards. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. And we have Peter Grandich and Bob Hoy. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, my featured guest today has advised institutional clients for over three decades. Bob Hoy is editor-in-chief investment strategist of institutionaladvisors.com. And Bob, I understand it's just lovely today in Vancouver.
Yeah, we've got 40 degrees and sunshine. And you've got to understand that this part of Canada is, we call it the banana belt. It's because it's always milder. And it's a very easy climate to live in.
After the most mild winter that I can recall in decades, roads are shut down. At least 6 inches of solid accumulation on the roads, I'd say, are close to it.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at the eastern side of the, you know, east of the Rockies, and the temperatures are, you know, they get that 14-day forecast, and they put in the bands, typical high and the typical low. In some places, like even down to St. Louis, Missouri, the high is below the typical low band, and there's another, it's essentially 2 weeks of it yet to come. And I just out of curiosity, I checked them for Duluth and Detroit, and then right up into Canada, Toronto, places like that, and it is unusually cold.
Yep, well, so much for global warming, I guess.
We can talk about that one on another edition.
Yeah, let's do that. We have in the past and bored people's socks off, so we won't force them to endure that episode again. But start today, Bob, with the latest Fed meeting. You know, we heard from the Fed minutes last week. You could tell the governors are in no hurry to increase the benchmark lending rate. Clearly, some of the policymakers are inclined to hold rates steady, those unsettling conditions in the Eurozone. You know, we see, of course, Greece trying to determine whether or not they will remain a viable component in the Euro region. And I think there's also some concern on the economic numbers. You know, although things were robust for a couple of months, they tend to be around the holidays. And of course, with the cold weather, we're seeing some declining economic numbers here domestically. We also saw housing starts drop off. Factory production was lackluster. Economic output maybe not quite as robust as people thought. Tell us what you think about the Fed meeting minutes and what it might mean for the markets, please.
Well, I think a month or so ago, Janet Yellen said something that they would leave perhaps the administered rate to follow what market rates of short rates do. I thought that was an interesting revelation. I don't know how widely it was broadcast, but essentially the Federal Reserve had been running a scam now for 100 years, and they are just winging it. On one side, they want to look like they're in control, but when interest rates are going up for market forces, they then try and do something else. But let's just take a look at, if you read the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, the writer reviews the intention of forming the Federal Reserve back in the early days. And they had observed that if you have a financial pressures mounting, the discovery of bad lending, which you often get on a boom, they theorized that if the Federal Reserve was there to provide liquidity, like the lender of last resort thing, that then there wouldn't be financial setbacks and then there wouldn't be recessions. That was the theory. So then you look back and using the NBER determination of business cycle, there's been 19 recessions since. There's been two financial manias, 1929 and 2007, and two drastic financial collapses. And so here, and then even on the drastic financial collapses, rather than just ordinary ones, in the 1970s, the then young and much admired liberal economist, Lester Thurow, he said, well, of course, policymaking's working. It's prevented the last six recessions from turning into a depression. If you follow the business cycle to the peak in 1929 from the depression bottom in 1895, there were 10 booms and busts, recessions and contractions and expansions. And then, of course, up to 2007, that was number 10. So you don't start worrying about a potential depression at the sixth recession. So the problem with the dominant economic theory, which is to intervene for any reason, is that these guys have theories that are based not upon history or empirical evidence, but just upon notions. And that notion is very old. The first guy to come up with the idea that you could throw credit at a credit contraction and it would go away occurred a long time ago. There was a credit boom in England and that blew out in 1618, repeat 1618, crashed down to 1623, lots of hardship, unemployment, a whole nasty mess. And then a guy by the name of Edward Misselden, in an otherwise a relatively sane paper, pamphlet, did include the idea that you could create money from somewhere and get it into the credit markets and all would be well. And then, of course, you then move forward to 1873 when, in still very admired guy, Bagehot, he headed up the Economist magazine. And in 1873, he published a book called The Lombards, which was the financial center. And in that book, he theorize that with a financial setback, the senior central bank could provide enough funds to prevent a serious contraction. 1873 was the top of a bubble, and the Depression lasted to 1895. So then you came along, and then in 1930, well, prior to 1929, Keynes was relatively lucid. And then he'd made money for his college at Twitter, Cambridge, whatever it was for, maybe on inside information, I don't know. But he took a tremendous hit in the 1929 crash, and then looked around and invented this concept called the liquidity preference, and theorized that if an agency provided lots of credit, the credit contraction would go away. So the amazing thing is that Friedrich Hayek, in the 1940s and later, said that at the time that Keynes put together his theory published in 1936, he was completely ignorant of financial or economic history. So all of this is intuitive. And just to wrap this one up, Chris, the reason why something as absurd as Keynesian economics and intervention came to the forefront and has been dominant is that it provides huge funds and power to the state. If it didn't do that, it wouldn't be around. So now, of course, it's become absolutely dominant, whereby half the world is hanging on the conjectural statements by the current head of the Federal Reserve. And sure, it can move markets, but at some point, historians will look backwards on this thing and say it was absolutely absurd. The audacity of these people who think that they have the skills to manage an economy.
A contemporary of John Maynard Keynes, Frank Knight, an American economist from the Middle West, who eventually found his way to the University of Chicago and helped craft the Chicago School of Economics as we know it today. In fact, he undoubtedly would have received a Nobel Prize in economics if one had existed at the time. And several of his well-known students subsequently did earn said prize, including Milton Friedman. But Frank Knight had a very witty, down-to-earth manner, and he echoed your sentiments that economics is a profoundly simple subject. The current neo-Keynesian methodology and ideologies are so foreign from what I think Dr. Keynes would have recognized at his time, nearly 100 years ago.
Well, Keynes did have the notion that a government could operate counter to whatever was going, both fiscally and financially. So he had the idea that it was not a one-way street of accommodating everything in sight. But you had another American economist. He worked at Chase Bank, Benjamin Anderson. He was the economist at Chase, wrote his monthly piece through the 1920s, and he had a handle on financial asset inflation and also wrote the best account afterwards. But the interesting thing is that the head of that bank then was a guy by the name of Wiggin, and in 1929, at the top of the market, he shorted, not only sold his own stock, but he shorted Chase Manhattan stock at the top of the market. Then it crashed, he made money, and of course the establishment got upset, so then there was a little bill or an act or something he put in afterwards that then bank directors couldn't short their own stocks.
The one who really made the fortune during the 29 crash was Livermore. The rumors, I think, far outweigh the truth here. I mean, according to the legend, I mean, he was so heavily short that he made close to $200 million, which at that time would be several billion dollars.
I've read some good sources on Livermore and on a day-to-day basis, and he played the short side of the market all the way down, you know, shorting, covering, all the way down. And he made about $25 million by the time he got to the bottom. And then, personally, something went wrong with him so that by about 1940, he couldn't play the long side. whereas hitherto he could.
Jim Sinclair, his father, actually worked with Jesse Livermore on a daily, you know, a regular basis. And I've gotten the inside scoop on the air and off the air over the years, information that you will not find in any of the interesting books that we've all read on Jesse Livermore. And really, none of the things that have been written about the near the end of his life are true, that he actually wasn't broke. He got a couple bad apples working for him in that office.
Well, I know he, and on the boom, he had something like 15 people, guys working with him, mainly, you know, getting information. His office had about 15 people in it just to, you know, keep track of things. But anyways, it's always interesting to talk history. And the question was, what about the central bank utterances? I think that deep inside each one of them, they know that they're in a very, very bad place. They've got a tiger by the tail, and the moment they quit pushing credit out, and who knows, the Fed said that it stopped the buying of bonds, but there's other manipulations that they can do, and of course they passed the baton over to the European Central Bank, and it's supposedly buying bonds, but I read one here this morning where the institutions there are not selling bonds because they would have to pay huge capital gains. And if you're a life company or a casualty insurance, you've got certain actuarial things to meet. So, and their demands are sort of like 3 to 3.5% annually. And so they sell what they got, pay a huge capital gain, and then reinvest at half of 1%. So they're just not doing it. So it's going to be interesting how successful the European community is at inflating credit. My view is to watch commodities, and if they continue to be dull and disappointing, it's an indication that the only hookup that the central bankers have is with their easing is with financial assets. And you got to go back to the 70s. Well, actually, you know, when you think about it, Chris, the gold bug story has been around since the mid-1960s, Jim Dines and others. But at that time, when I was working with a high-end investment dealer, this was sort of looked at scornfully. But it's worked out. But the story essentially was is that the Fed is depreciating currency. And if you were a gold bug, then gold would outperform everything else. But if you were a hard asset guy, commodities, then they would outperform everything else. And what you did have was a tremendous inflation in commodities, producer prices, and wages. And that peaked in 1980 at a huge speculative blow-off in commodities. And then, much like 1920, in which case there was then a crash in commodities. And the interesting thing is that since then, because Volcker was head of the Fed then, he's given credit for ending inflation. If you take a look at the annual money supply numbers, there was no break. They kept inflating credit, but the public shifted over from speculating in commodities. And by the bear market bottom in 82 and the turn to the bull market, then they began in speculating in financial assets. Now, I was providing institutional services then and was really just starting to market it because prior to that I'd been retained by a couple of the big mining companies for research on metals. But going to the institutions then in 1981, my pitch was that no matter how much the Fed prints, financial assets will outperform commodities. Now, at that stage of history, major institutions in North America had finally figured out that inflation wasn't due to prices going up. It was due to the Fed depreciating. So they had just discovered the cause of inflation, and they couldn't accept a story that type of inflation was over and you'd have a new kind. And even to this day, your typical central banker hasn't got a clue about financial asset inflation. And indeed, whenever they mention inflation, it only means CPI inflation. So they're in a hellhole, really. Maybe some realize it, but you've got this condition whereby interventionists have not just been in the credit market, but there's so many rules and regulations in Western economies now, just unbelievable, that is throttling business inclinations and abilities. So it's just got a chokehold on it. And then they arbitrarily decide that GDP should be higher or employment should be better. And what did they resort to? Credit inflation. And it's been going into financial assets. You've got, in Europe, you've got the 10-year German note bid down to 0.35%. I mean, it's totally absurd. Interest rates have never been this low, but the really curious thing is that the guys at the central banks don't understand it. They think, oh, they want to get inflation up to 2%, which is state theft, of course. And so I want, when I get asked about Fed policy, the usual is that they don't know what they're doing. And at some point, as in 1980, where the public had speculated enough in hard assets, got burned out, and then a couple of years later started to play in financial assets. So now, this is why, since, you know, you've been in a bear market for commodities and base metals, and for precious metals since 2011. And at the same time, central bankers in the West see with easing credit. So here's where the really tricky part comes in, Chris, is that without a bid in the financial markets, would the central bankers have been as successful in getting credit out? Because I think that they need speculators in something in order to expand their portion of the credit expansion. When is the speculation in long treasuries? Well, that peaked five or 6 weeks ago, and we did our usual technical analysis on it, and we had upside exhaustions and all kinds of things on it, and wrote that this was probably the opposite to the bond market in 1981, when you had U.S. long treasury trading at 15%. It got under 2%. So this will tell the tale, Chris. If a bear market for the long bond develops, then they're pushing on a rope. Low-grade junk corporate bonds in the U.S., a speculative high last June. And then they've had a huge setback to the middle of December, had a rebound where they're now overbought and can head south. So what I think is going to happen here is that the credit markets have become extremely speculative. The treasury bond has become as speculative. Stock market has been in highly speculative conditions, showing sentiment and momentum numbers seen only at previous cyclical highs. So it's all there. Party time. And if I were a fund manager, I don't know what I'd do, because by now I think the average fund manager has figured out that what's keeping the stock market up is the aggressive action by central bankers, and also they're very speculative utterances where, you know, it's. I think at some point here they're going to have in the mornings, the Federal Reserve say that it's going to be easing, and then in the afternoons in Europe, the central bank in Europe is going to have to say they're easing, because this is what is driving the market. I looked at a study here the other day of from, I think, the 60s, and they took the Standard & Poor's Monthly, and they ran it, you know, as it is, not adjusted by anything, and then they adjusted it for, and they took the, each year they took out the 25 big updates out of it, where you had, they had it at $1,000 in, say, 1965, it got up to $5,000 in 2000, back down, and then now it's sort of like 3,900. So if you take out the 25 best days of a year, there's not been a huge amount of growth in the stock market since 2000. So then I'm going to get in touch with the guys who did the study. then they should do is put in how many of those big days in the stock market were due to a Fed announcement. Curious, isn't it? It's interesting. So, yeah, so it's become actually a highly promotional world on the central banking side. Their theories that they can run and manage an economy have always been highly speculative. And now they're adding that to, with day-to-day market operations that are speculative as well. And then you've got the fund managers who should not be speculative, but they have become speculative. So it's fascinating because Keynesian economist, lefty guy, I don't remember his name, Professor Tobin, in the 80s said that a bubble is a speculation upon what other speculators are doing in their speculations, something like that. I haven't got it word perfect. So we are in a fantastic bubble, and the old notion of Keynes for that the federal, that the central bank should sort of lean into the wind a little isn't happening.
I mean, what's happened is when you open up Pandora's box, as Keynes proposed and many others, on paper, it's a fantastic equation. The problem is, in practice, by around the year 2000, we had, of course, as you know, lost our fail-safes that we'd picked up during the 1930s as a result of maybe the most notable speculative bubble that we had had in many generations. We had those fail-safes. We kept the investment banking side away from the day-to-day mom-and-pop banking, and that kept the speculation, at least on a big scale, out of the markets. But what happens when you remove those fail-safes and then it still isn't enough to save the system? The Fed has to come in with the working group of markets, so they keep pouring money into the money center banks. Those banks then dole out the funds to the major corporations. The corporations certainly don't do anything with it except buy back their own treasury stock.
They're borrowing money to buy their stock. Talking to an accountant in New Jersey the other day, and he says some of his big account guys, they've been in business long enough to run a pretty tight ship, and they found that so they laid on a whole lot of debt. And they didn't earn any more money, but the stock went up. Here's the point where we're talking about central banks. And I made this note just yesterday, so it's fresh out. This is by Dr. Pippa Malmgren, and she's a former member of the U.S. President's Working Group on Financial Markets, i.e., that was the plunge protection team. So now she's coming out and saying that there is no price discovery anymore by the market. Governments impose prices on the market. And this is where you have such loftiness in the stock market. But my contention is that they cannot run it forever. Also, that there's no way that these guys are going to get religion and suddenly say, hey, what we've been doing is wrong, and stop doing it. So then Mother Nature and Mr. Market, Mr. Margin, are going to do it to them. And so then you want to see where the hottest action has been. And to 2011, it was base metals and precious metals. 2008 was the huge blow-off in crude oil. And then the failure since last June in crude oil is a very important step. And all of the easing in the world isn't going to hold crude oil from... Sure, it's going to... We ran it, as you recall, that once you get a bear market going in crude, that it can last... The severe part can last 6 or 7 months. Now, that counted out to January. So in January, we noted this, and we'd been talking about the count to January, and when it was down at 43 or whatever it was kind of oversold. But here's the other part of historical research, is that once the, say, let's call it the initial low was in, that you don't get a V-bottom and you go right back on up. You can take months to set a bottom with churning back and forth. So this is where I think the wild action in crude since January has been that there's a lot of bulls out there thinking of V-bottom, and then there's Mother Nature thinking otherwise. So, and on, I forget which one it was, but the shortest bottom in a time in establishing a bottom after a crude crash was 2 months. So, no, I think there's no need to run into crude. And, of course, it's having a dampening effect on the commodities that have been coming down since 2011. So I think the commodity side will tell the tale. Then on the other side, you go back to 2006, which was the peak in the housing mania with subprime mortgages and the government urging people, all people should own houses, whether they could afford it or not, and the whole thing was rigged. So then you got the equivalent now going on in car sales. People are taking 7-8 year loans on car sales, and there's a whole sub-industry set up bundling up car loans and turning them into A-rated mortgage bonds. So it's the same thing, only in something as perishable as a car rather than a house. And they're even doing used cars on this. So at any rate, here's a place to watch would be car sales. You can't say it's insanity or madness on the part of the policymakers, because underneath it all, they are rational people. But what you can say is fanaticism. And they're in too deep to quit, and as the very vivid imagery of holding a tiger by the tail very much illustrates what's going on, you can't let go. We're watching any price series that has been a blow-off condition to reverse. The latest one, of course, is the Treasury market. And the stock market staying in there. And if you look at the broader market, the U.S. NYSE composite, the symbol's NYA, it's sort of working on a big rounded top. And then we're just doing a chart now on the global equity market, not including U.S. And it's in a similar pattern seen in 2007. Also seen in 2000. So we have those two recent examples to guide us in the stock market. And I don't think, now here we're going to finish up with gold. The latest rally was very nice. My colleague Ross Clark is the technician in our team, and he was calling for a correction down to 1200 to 1225. So we're there, but we're not yet calling for a rally in gold's dollar price. And then this also is worth pointing out that the when you're positioning gold, you're essentially, you could say the old idea you can own 5 or 10% of your assets in gold, put it in the safety deposit box, that's sound. But if you're positioning gold to make a capital gains out of it, that's not going to work. What you're doing is essentially trading in foreign exchange markets. So whether it's somebody in the U.S. positioning against U.S. dollars or Canada with Canadian or European, that is a speculation in foreign exchange. What we prefer to do is work with investors and on sound principles of investing and look at the gold mining industry. And it rests upon the profitability of gold mining. How much are they getting for the bullion, and how much are their costs are. Now, here's the irony, is that when you're in a business boom, usually the cost of everything goes up relative to the price of gold, and gold miners don't do so well. But when you're in a deflationary contraction, typically the price of most everything falls relative to gold. So the way we keep track of this is with the gold divided by our own commodities index. And it set what we took to be a cyclical low in June last year, and it's recovered a huge amount. But because you got so much excitement in junk bonds, but certainly in treasuries and then in the stock markets, there's no time for the gold. So the gold's real price is on a cyclical bull market and will more than likely continue. The gold stocks came down to a very nasty low in around Christmas time. Now, our November special study on gold pointed all this out and said that what we needed for the position in gold shares would be, first of all, to have gold stocks outperforming the bullion price. That has been happening. The other one would be silver beginning to outperform gold, and that's been bottoming and basing as well. So the idea was to accumulate gold stocks on weaker markets, but we're not fully invested yet because this bottom here can be a long process. We know that the juniors are, but it's kind of improving a little.
You know, we are seeing improvement in the XAU, HUI. It's slow but steady, backing and filling. The one caveat that I think is keeping a lot of technicians up at night, consolidation at the same level now for almost a year, maybe going on a year and a half. That's an ominous sign from a long, long-term basis. It implies a strong potential for a capitulation moment, which might be what's necessary, I think, to shake the weak hand, the folks that were late to the bull market, out of this market. I certainly hope I'm wrong.
We agree that the gold's dollar price is precarious, but I'll take you one step further on our historical work, and that is in the post-bubble environment, the senior currency, which is still the U.S., becomes chronically strong or firm relative to most commodities, and relative to most commodities for most of the time, which has been happening. And so how do we then balance our different views whereby we're looking for a constantly firmer U.S. dollar and we're bullish on the gold industry? So you have to take out the dollar price of gold and look at the real price. And if the real price is going up, the profitability will eventually start, operating profitability will eventually come in, because you're dealing with a bear market in the gold sector. You saw the end of a 10-year bull market in 2011 where the seniors like Barrick Gold were doing certain geology in uncertain political regimes and then getting into copper and stuff like that. So all of those bad mistakes have yet to be washed out, but we'll just stay with our point of view that investors will be looking to the earnings side of gold shares. And they will also understand that on the next recession, that the real price of gold will continue to go up and profitability will continue to improve for the industry. And then I'll just throw in that in all of the five previous post-bubble contractions, gold mining became the premier industry. Now, there could be some new industries or new concepts, new technical stuff, and create a bubble, or not a bubble, but a good returns from that particular stock. But the one thing that you can analyze is that in a post-bubble contraction, eventually the gold sector becomes the premier and the most reliable money earner. And this is... We're getting close to starting that, Chris, so you can mark us down as very bullish on the long term, very careful on the entry.
As I'm sure you remember, last week, the Swedish Central Bank has dropped rates into negative territory. There's capital controls in all over Scandinavia, including Denmark. We're seeing the ECB now has one of its lending rates in negative territory. And as we learned from, Barsky and Summers, when you have negative real rates, that is a perfect world for gold. And it certainly would support your thesis that maybe we see a stealth rally in the precious metals on a forward basis. Bob Hoy, could you please tell our listeners today more about the interesting services you provide and how they can sign up for them?
We do research on a weekly basis, covers interest rates, credit spreads, yield curve, commodities, and we do some unique research on the precious metals sector. We send the same product to institutions, to high net worth people and individuals, and you can find us at institutionaladvisors.com, or an easier way is just to Google my name, B-O-B-H-O-Y-E, Bob Hoy, and that gets you into our service. And we welcome new subscribers, and we put you on the system for 5 or 6 weeks. If you like it, you stay on and pay a fee, and if you don't, that's fine too. So easy to get in touch with.
Excellent. Well, Bob Hoy, we appreciate your thoughts, and we'll look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com Radio.
Very good, Chris. Look forward to talking to you.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Welcome back, Peter Grandich.
Thank you for having me.
I thought we could start off today with, you know, a discussion on Hugo Salinas Price and his efforts as president of the Mexican silver, introducing undenominated silver coins into several countries, including his own nation, Greece as well, as emergency money. And he adds that countries continue buying gold. Russia, China seem to be preparing for some big event he thinks is a result of Western meddling. I'd like your thoughts as to whether or not you think this could be an emergency plan that every listener should be thinking about, some type of contingency.
I think we always have to have a contingency. I think history has demonstrated that no paper currency forever remains the strength of what it may have at a particular time in history and eventually collapses or disappears. And certainly in the state of geopolitical environment that we see here throughout the world, it certainly is something that's of a positive nature. And I just think it's just wise, just as it is to have 6 months' worth of supplies, both food and money and what have you. It's the same as, you know, having something as an alternative to paper currency, no matter what paper currency you may be using.
We've all seen what can happen to any currency. I mean, look at all the turmoil, particularly in South America as well as in the Eurozone. I mean, we're seeing country after country now. And we're also seeing negative interest rates from Scandinavia all throughout Central Europe. So the central bankers and the powers that be understand there's a currency war. It's global in scope, and it has and will have far-reaching effects. I mean, as Americans, we feel insulated, but we have to remember that we are only 25% of the world economy, which if we kind of take the complement of that equation, you recognize that, yes, 25% may be a big chunk, but there's another 75% out there, so we're not completely insulated. Today, Fed Janet Yellen waived a copy of the central bank's audited financial statement before Congress in front of Dr. Ron Paul's son, Rand Paul, a prop for transparency, if you will. But, you know, there are some detractors who are concerned there is very little transparency. We're not sure what's going on behind the scenes at the Fed. We haven't pulled the curtain back yet. Tell us what you think about this effort on the Fed's part. Is this merely just a smokescreen?
My always belief, even though when we go in a court of law, we're not supposed to hold it against somebody if they decide not to testify. If I'm innocent, I'm going to testify no matter what. I can't see how not testifying helps my cause if I'm innocent. If I'm not afraid that they're not going to find gold in Fort Knox. Go take a look. I'll lead the congressional and Senate leaders myself around if I'm the Fed chairman. The bottom line is it was a smokescreen. It has always been a concern. An audit would show horrific, terrible things that would, you know, could rock the economic world and tear it apart. My view is that as much as we now have supposedly yet another investigation into banks manipulating gold, look, you don't have to have an investigation. Now, the problem is 99.9% of the world doesn't watch gold trade each day, certainly not the way the public watches the stock market or what have you. But those of us who still do see just total abnormalities happen time in and time out. You can't go down 98% of the time every time there's an employment number. You can't always have a rise in Asia, and as soon as London opens, we just peel off. You can't drop, you know, 2% in 5 minutes when there's no supporting news at all. I mean, those things are just not normal. And this is to me, the smoking gun, is that we've already seen legitimately that all other markets have been manipulated. So why on earth can anybody somehow think that at the door of the COMEX, the manipulation stops? I mean, it's absurd, but because so few people have a direct interest in it, it doesn't get traction. And unless someone comes out and admits to something terrible, which first kind of breaks on TMZ, not on CNBC, and then it snowballs, it's going to take a real whistleblower to finally come out, because we all know that anybody that's watched it for years, the gold market and silver market is used mostly from a manipulated side to the downside, not the upside.
It appears to be central bank officials' favorite mechanism to help with the monetary plans they put in place, because they have that leverage there, constant manipulation charges.
As much as I believe you're right that governments use the markets, I also believe that what's happened is because there's such a narrow participation and the public at large is not involved, I think those that are left in the trading have concluded that, hey, listen, we could push this market around when we want to, and pushing it down, any market is always easier to push down than up. And so what happens is those who may not be involved in the manipulation know it's happening in their pros, so they step aside or they join in it, and it becomes really a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's really become acute now. It happens so often and so regular that even those of us who still watch it on a regular basis kind of accept it. It's really not given any impetus to someone to get on the long side, because your feeling is, hey, if I go long, I'm only going to get crushed by these people. What do I need to do that for? And so I really think they have controlled the market. And if not for the real physical demand that underlines this market, the paper pushers probably would have succeeded all along with the belief of getting it below 1,000. But it's the physical demand that eventually overpowers that selling short and limits to how much they can move it around. But they still make a decent dollar, and it's on the short side. You just can't have 98 out of 90 times a market going down in a certain period and around certain economic events. It's just scientists will just tell you economic statistics would argue that that's just not right, that there's something artificial being done to have that happen. But no one really cares, because there isn't really any general public participation.
It all seems to come back to the lack of transparency, and that's where that battle occurred today, I think, in Congress. The powers that be argue, look, if we telegraph what we're doing and what our plans are, then every deep-pocketed investor around the world will simply front-run us, and they will destroy what it is we're trying to do. That's their argument for secrecy and lack of transparency. What it does, though, I think, is allow a very small cabal to run the show and do precisely what you just outlined, and that is make sure that the system is gamed in their favor.
One of the things I would say is if we talk to anybody that's still in the gold market, no one would be willing to make any bet, no matter what odds you give them, that suddenly there's going to be a $30 or $40 pop to the upside. The only way they'll make that bet is I'll bet it to the downside. And the reason that is because that's basically all that's basically happened over these last several years. And call it gold cartels, call it the crime X, as I like to call it whatever you want, or maybe just that the simplicity of it is those that remain in it know that, if anything, it's going to be pushed to the downside and not to the upside. But I do believe this. I do believe that the Federal Reserve has greatly overstepped its purpose. And the financial markets, while it's working for them now, are going to pay a very dear price. And what I mean is this. The mandate and what the Federal Reserve was created for was to protect and help serve the banking system. It was not supposed to be the engine that pulls not only this economy but the world economy around. But because there's been so lack of fiscal responsibility from both sides of the aisles for literally a couple decades now, whether it chose to, was forced into it, or a combination of both, it's taken over that role as well. And as good as it is right now for those who are benefiting, the big banks, the financial institutions, the stock market going and so forth and so on, it may not look like it to the naked eye, but they have painted themselves into the corner. And one of the difficulties I believe they're having right at the moment is to go ahead with the plan to raise interest rates as much as they want to. I am absolutely convinced the vast majority want to raise interest rates and raise them sharply. To do so now, especially with many signs that the economy is at least slowing from whatever pace it might have had a year ago, or even rolling over yet again, and what's happening around the world, to see any significant rise in interest rates right now could just kill whatever strength there is in the world economy. And so while it doesn't look like there's in a corner, they really are in a corner. And I can't figure out how they get out of that corner without some sort of crisis or some sort of prolonged underperformance. And what I'm noticing also in these last several weeks is many former bullish commentators, what have you, are seeing that and are noting shifts and desires to move away from U.S. asset base and going to what looks to be far more fairly valued assets across the seas. And you said earlier about a currency war. I don't know, Chris, if it's much of a currency war as a currency race. And what I feel in the difference is in a war, you know, you're looking to beat the other side and destroy them. I really think it's more of a race, and countries are trying to debase their currencies to stimulate the economies and really maybe don't care what that does to others, but their concerns about themselves. And while it looks good for America now that the dollar has done what it's done, it's really, really going to be detrimental to our system, because what we're going to see is, and we're already seeing it, is we're going to see that shift away from the United States for money flows and what have you. And the soon, eventually, no matter how much money the Fed creates, it's not going to be able to move our economy forward. And these are like big battleships. You can't turn these things overnight. So there's a significant slowdown in America coming simply because of what's happening in the currencies, let alone all the other economic and geopolitical concerns that are impacting the U.S. economy.
Well, exactly. And when you talk about currency race, it's the race to the bottom, as we all know by now. And interestingly, that has one impact that just is inevitable. You cannot escape it, and that is rising prices. And I like to discuss an interesting article published today, actually, about inflation beginning to rear its head again in Japan. And it wasn't even a gold-centric article, but it just immediately started to raise flags in my mind when I saw that people are finding it difficult in Japan, of all places, to make ends meet and to buy just basic necessities. Some searches online after reading the article and started to look at the wine inflation and other inflations, and it showed the price of gold in March works. From 1916, 1917, 1918, gold was exactly at the current price. It was bouncing around about 800 to 1,000 marks. Then suddenly it spiked up to 1,200, 1,300. You know, we can compare that with the U.S. dollar terms of gold today. In the blink of an eye, it was at 10,000 marks, and then 100,000 marks. And then, you know, it went up to something like 100 quadrillion marks. I mean, just an unfathomable number. You just saw these hints. You had these telltale signs where just a few people were prescient enough to take some steps to insulate themselves, prepare for what was coming. Given this backdrop, do you think that we could see, not the same, I don't expect history to repeat, but could we get a rhyming effect here? I mean, could we see these negative real rates finally usher in a tidal wave-like effect in prices?
Because interest rates have become down to next to nothing, and so is inflation. It won't take a large increase to see or feel as if there's been a large percentage increase. In other words, it's not going to take much to, on the upside, to get a sense of feeling that it's moving back up. And that is normally movement of feeling versus results. You know, when people were in the heights of bad inflation, people ran out because if they don't buy the bread today, in an hour it could be a lot higher. It really was only because everybody else was thinking that, not because it was that much more costly to produce that.
By the time people recognize that's occurring, good luck finding any gold or silver or anything that could insulate you.
Right. What I found most interesting in these last several weeks, in fact, I just shared that in a talk last week, I found perhaps the most interesting thing in 2015 to me was the tremendous turnaround of Alan Greenspan, who has started to talk in some of the things that we've spoken about today. Here's a guy that if you read when he was chairman of what he viewed the world and what he said and what he's now speaking about, you could almost, he's not there yet, but he certainly could attend a gold bug meeting. It's really interesting that that man, who's really the godfather of where we are today, there have been successors, obviously, at his post, and Bernanke and now Yellen, but clearly much of why we're at where we are now is because of what he led to this point. To see him be so critical and so overly concerned now, to me, is a man who's realizing he made and was part of some very, very serious errors in judgment. I really believe that the unspoken news of 2015 has been the change in the man of Alan Greenspan and his perceptions. And so when I tie that into seeing people like Robert Shiller say after years and years it's time to move away from U.S.-based assets, and seeing all sorts of key people, maybe not the talking heads yet, that you know are flooded on places like Tau TV and CNBC, but the last of the really independent people out there are becoming really, really concerned. I think you have to take notice.
You know, with all due respect to him, I fear that he really was duped. Sort of went along with the party line and really believed the mantra, we can control this genie. If we let this monetary genie out of the bottle, you know, we can always contain it if we want to. We can do what Paul Volcker did in the 70s and 1980 and contain it. Ironically, I'll bet he is quietly accumulating substantial precious metals.
He's openly spoken about it, which is unfathomable if you think about what we thought of when he was chairman and what our mindset was. To hear him actually speak as he's spoken as now, so-called, as a private citizen. Now, if you take that one step and if you go to the Don't Worry Happy Crowd on Wall Street and say, hey, wait a minute, this was your guy. I mean, this is the godfather of what's transpired, and he's now telling to own gold. Hello. They probably go, oh, he's lost it. You know, he's gotten old. He's got dementia. They couldn't begin to rally around the thought that someone of his nature and his background could actually suggest owning gold. And I think that's probably the most overlooked geoeconomic factor of what's taken place in these last few months.
It's the wake-up call. He must have caught considerable flack. Unfortunately, I'm afraid that history might view him as an unwitting John Law of our generation, because it was that ideology created this monster where we have to loosen the restrictions that came from the 1930s, from the last speculative credit expansion-based boom. All that conspired together to lead to the greatest housing boom and then bust in history, stock market bubble, and many other bubbles. And now it's a giant mess. Sadly, just like John Law, was really almost a victim of his own success. And, you know, I didn't even get a chance to ask you how the operation went. I understand there was a procedure done.
Right. It's not a major one, a foot operation. I'm hopping around at the moment, but everything should go well. And thank you very much for asking.
Well, we wish you a speedy recovery, sir. Could you tell folks more about the interesting services that you provide?
Sure. I do write for MoneyTalks.net, and then I have a retirement estate planning and business planning firm in New Jersey called Trinity Financial Sports and Entertainment Management.
Very good. We want to thank you for your thoughts today, sir.
Thank you.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. A report on Mining.com discussed how Apple Computer may soon be purchasing up to one-third of the world's annual global gold production to meet the projected sales demand of the forthcoming Apple Watch. The high-end model of the Apple Watch is going to feature an 18-karat gold casing. Interest in this option is gaining momentum, and word on the street is that Apple is taking steps to have enough of them on hand to meet demand. A Wall Street Journal article discussed how Apple expects to produce over 1 million watches a month, starting in the second quarter of the year, with high demand coming from Asian markets, primarily China. Estimates are that each high-end Apple Watch will contain 2 troy ounces of gold. When you compare projected sales to that amount of gold per watch, Apple will need 746 tons of gold per year, which is about 30% of the global annual production, according to this article. The Apple Watch would get people to buy gold. People may not buy gold for gold's sake, but they would be buying gold by obtaining an Apple Watch. If the market projections are as forecast, I think it's a brilliant strategy to encourage gold acquisition by individuals. I have been an Apple aficionado, even when it was very unpopular to do so. Back in the late 1980s and early 1990s, when the PC and browser wars were raging, You know, many are raising a hairy eyebrow to the idea now of Apple entering the electric car space by 2020. All you need to do is Google connected car, or look at the offerings at the recent Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. How we connect our phone, our car, our computer is our future in many respects. The fact that gold has been introduced into one of these categories is a paradigm shift that is and was highly unexpected. With gold as an integral component in high-end Apple watches, the very product you buy may not depreciate in value over time. It may very well outperform stocks and other asset classes as paper currencies the world over continue to devalue against physical metal. An Apple Watch may be one of the most usable and practical investments in gold one can make. I'll be anxious to see the finished product. Chris, I'm going to be releasing an updated version of my book on conquering change early this summer. I'd like to urge all of our listeners interested in learning more to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at conquerchange. Thanks, Chris.